This Dharma talk was presented at the Austin Zen Center in Austin, Texas. For more information, visit austinzencenter.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to everyone online. This is a topic that came to me, right speech, kind speech, because a teaching about this came up recently in a Dharma talk given by somebody else. I think it was the Reverend Royce who mentioned this instruction when he gave a talk a couple of weeks ago, Royce Johnson from the Houston Zen Center. And he mentioned this set of instructions about speech, which come directly from the Buddha and are spread out throughout the Pali canon, the body of teachings in the Pali language that are said to be directly from the Buddha. And as Royce noted, these instructions are a kind of mindfulness training. And many of you may have heard these guidelines. They're out on the internet. I see them on Facebook sometimes. So here they are. They're very simple. This is when considering whether to speak, whether to say something, we should ask these questions of ourselves. Is it true what we want to say? Is it kind? Is it beneficial? Is it necessary? And is it the right time? How many of you have heard these before? Many of you. Yes, lots of you. Okay, very good. And they always strike me every time I hear them because I think, oh, I don't do this. a lot of the time, I just open my mouth, right? So it's good to keep those in mind, and I think I agree with Royce that these are, at their core, a kind of mindfulness, like a pause that you open up before you enter what is for us really habitual activity, right? Our patterns of speech, you know, are habitual. Now, we can only do our best with these guidelines, or at least aim at our best, right? For example, you know, we might repeat something that we think is true or believe is true. Our best information is that it's true, but it isn't true. It turns out not to be true. Has this ever happened to any of you? Yes, okay. We hope it will be beneficial. Our intention is that it's a benefit, but it goes completely sideways, right? Our intention is benefit, and then we see that there's an impact which isn't beneficial, right? Or it seems necessary. I'm going to say something, and it seems like the right time. But despite our pausing to consider these questions and our investigating as best we can, you know, these questions, right, those things aren't the case either. It turns out not to be the right time. And it turns out, you know, that it's not necessary. It wasn't necessary. But of these characteristics, these five, the slippery one for me is the second one, right? Is it kind? Because kind can be kind of sly, right? It can be a form of avoidance. I'm not going to say what I really think. I'm going to try to be kind. I'm going to be kind. Okay. It can be a form of avoidance, or it can even be false speech, right? Ingratiating speech. Speech that flatters but isn't true for us, or speech that's manipulative, right? And some teacher once was asked in my presence in a talk, what's the difference between manipulation and skillful means, right? There isn't any. It's like, it's a very fine line between doing something skillful that helps the individual in front of you, that's appropriate in that moment, and manipulating the situation or the person. Or trying to look good. Look at me, I'm kind. Right? But there are other teachings that help us with these bare sort of guideposts to mindfulness and investigation, I'm trying to check in with our intention. And I think the most helpful of these is the teachings that we have on compassion. So, for example, Roshi Joan Halifax, who is the abbot of Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe, she says that compassion is the ability, this is a quote from her, the ability to turn toward the truth of suffering with the wish to relieve that suffering. So it's not just confronting suffering or facing suffering, but it's with this wish to relieve it, whether it's your suffering or someone else's suffering. And for Roshi Joan, compassion is central to being fully human. And I think that this two-part definition is important, not just to be willing to witness and to be with suffering, which is important, right? Not to flee or do something immediately to alleviate it, like, you know, whatever it is that you do, eat a box of Oreos. You know, that was my go-to at one point, the Oreos.
One opportunity after.
Okay, we can eat the box of Oreos, I'm told, after this talk. Right? You might have some competition. Right, so not just to be with and to witness, to accompany suffering, but to accompany that action of being with, of being still with, that with the wish, cultivating the wish to relieve it. And we should also remember that our ethical precepts, of which right speech is one, our ethical, actually it's three, I'll get to that in a minute, our ethical precepts, you know, they're rooted in compassion. They sound like a list of do's and don'ts often when we begin our practice, but they are rooted in compassion. And we should remember also that centering compassion in our practice, as, rather than like policing ourselves and policing others, is a way to balance our tendency to want to control things, which we all do. So I think that squarely facing the impulse to control, whether it's speech or something else, is really important, and it helps us when we don't succeed or when our attempts to align ourselves with these five guidelines don't turn out the way we want them to. Now, the early teachings of the Buddha, the suttas, which I mentioned at the beginning, speak of controlling the mind. And that's the word, control. Controlling the mind. And this sort of seems artificial and coercive. Whenever I hear that word control, you know, that's what I think of. Kind of coercion arises, this feeling of coercion. But we should remember that even in the Buddha's early teachings, the purpose of this control is in order to not create harm for ourselves or others with speech or action or thought. Right? Speech, action, and thought are the three ways in which we create karma with intentional action. So control, in this case, is not about repression. It's about non-harming. And controlling ourselves is especially emphasized in the teachings about speaking. So if you've looked at the precepts, the bodhisattva precepts that we work with, speech is a prominent element. And right speech is also an element in the Buddha's Eightfold Path. That's his first teaching, right? The Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And in the Eightfold Path, right speech is further defined as not lying, not slandering, not using harsh speech. This is my favorite. Not engaging in idle chatter. We're doomed. And more. But again, while the suttas urge us to control ourselves, they do so emphasizing harmony, the harmony of the community, rather than obedience. Right? So it's not about sin. It's not about, you know, failure to keep the precepts. It's about harmony in the Sangha. And the Sangha can be very broadly defined, not just us in this room, but everything, all beings. And sometimes the suttas suggest that we abandon an old, unwholesome state that has already arisen, despite our efforts at mindfulness and control of our minds. And to me, abandoning, that word in English, has a kind of different nuance than control, as does the word refrain or abstain, which are other words that are sometimes used, as in to refrain or abstain from lying or some other unwholesome action. those words to me convey more the spirit of what these instructions are about rather than control in English. Right, so the harmony of the Sangha, and that is considered actually one of the gravest transgressions against the precepts, is to destroy the harmony of the Sangha with speech, more than even harming a Buddha. That is considered the most grave in the early monastic regulations. So speech is really important. So as I've said, in Zen, we have 16 precepts, and in 10 of them, we list all the things that we don't do. Right? These are the so-called 10 grave precepts. And these sound, especially to those who are new to practice, like something like the 10 commandments. Right? In our translation here, we say, a disciple of Buddha does not kill. That's the first one. Right? A disciple of Buddha does not do X. The precepts can also be expressed as vows. So a disciple of the Buddha does not kill, it can come instead as the words, I vow not to kill. Right? I take this really seriously. I vow not to kill. And they can also be expressed in a positive way. Instead of not doing something, how do we express that precept in a positive way? So one commentary from Dogen, the founder of the Japanese Zen that we practice, he says, positively, the Buddha seed grows in accordance with not taking life. Transmit the life of Buddha's wisdom and do not kill. Which is also a very vast and expansive expression of this precept. The 10 grave precepts include 3 about speech. Not lying, that's sort of common to all ethical guidelines in almost all systems. Not slandering, not praising self and disparaging others. Right? Don't puff yourself up and put others down. Right? So explicitly about talking. Back to Joan Halifax, Roshi Joan says, and I agree with her on this one, it's true for me at least. She says, I think that no matter what kind of people are in a society or community, more difficult than intoxicants, more difficult than sex, the most difficult of all the guidelines we live by is speech. Further, she notes that Buddhist teachings understand that speech arises from our discriminating or judging mental activity, right, where we start dividing things up and categorizing them and judging them. Right? And what we're doing when we practice, especially when we're sitting zazen and then living our lives out of zazen, we balance this judging, dividing, discriminating mental activity, which is just what our minds do, right? We balance that by expressing the reality of stillness and silence in zazen. Right? We cultivate that. And Roshi Joan says, we're deeper than the mind that is discriminating, that is categorizing, that is caught in this little box-making. That's a quote. In sitting, we enter what she calls the mind and heart of transmission, which is nonverbal. The non-dual mind, the one that doesn't go this, that, you, me, right? The mind that's profoundly open. It's why when we do deep practice, for example, in retreat, we are in silence, and why we ask people not to read, not to get on the internet, not to write in their journals, not to check their phone messages, but to see if the speaking function can calm down. Behind that, then the thinking function can calm down. So beginner's mind, or the before thinking mind, the not knowing mind, the one that's not already got its mind made, the mind that doesn't have its mind made up, that mind can be more present. But when we do open our mouths, the positive expression of this function of our thinking minds is to offer kind speech. And so this is the other kind of speech. It's not other speech, but it's a type of speech that I wanted to also say some things about. So remember the Buddha's teaching about pausing to ask, is it kind? Right? And Dogen, again, our Japanese founder, offers us some guidance in this. He mentions kind speech in an essay that's called The Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance. Right? And the four methods that he offers us, how we should kind of orient our practice as bodhisattvas who are interested in the welfare of others, who actually dedicate themselves to others. These four are giving is the first one, kind speech is the second, beneficial action is the third, and the fourth is identity action. And in this essay, Dogen speaks of arousing the mind of compassion, which we talked about at the beginning here, and offering kind speech whenever you see sentient beings, offer them kind speech. And in Japanese, kind speech is aigo, which in Sanskrit is priya vakana. And that word means, apparently, kind, but also affectionate, or even loving words. So it's intimate. It's intimate. Kind can be kind of a facade, but loving and affectionate, that's more intimate. It's breaking down the barriers between this person and other people or beings. Dogen says, kind speech means that when you see sentient beings, you arouse the mind of compassion and offer words of love and care. It is contrary to cruel and violent speech. He says, you should be willing to practice it for the entire present life. I'd say through your whole lifetime, practice this practice. Dogen says, do not give up. So every time we mess up, go right back and try again. World after world, says Dogen, life after life, do this. Kind speech is the basis for reconciling rulers and subduing enemies, he says. You should know that kind speech arises from kind mind, and kind mind from the seed of compassionate mind. And he concludes with this kind of mind-blowing statement. He says, kind speech is not just praising the merit of others. It has the power to turn the destiny of the nation. And I want that to be true. So, and this is Roshi Jones' point also, that we should take these instructions with a very wide view of speech. And especially in this society that we are living in, this current society, a very literate society, awash in information of all kinds, with many forms of social media and many, many forms of communication. So actually, Roshi Jones suggests we consider not just right speech, but right communication. What is right communication? And we should remember that communication is reciprocal. Right? There's a giver and a receiver. And I think this is important even if we're just talking about speech. So like right now, I'm using words myself. And I'm trying to offer you something about the teachings. And you are listening to and being affected, but not only by my words, but how I offer them. And this is always horrifying when I listen to myself on a recording. Right? You are quite aware of my tone, my pitch, my phrasing, my gestures, my facial expressions, right? And whenever I hear my own voice, I think, oh, is that how I sound? Right? Often my intention and my the effect do not meet in my estimation. So in our practice of stillness and silence, you know, I sit zazen, not speaking, not moving, and I really feel some kind of a bright light feeling, some freedom when the words recede, when I'm sitting in silence. Something else can step forward, that something like maybe that mind that Roshi Halifax talks about, the one that is before thinking and discriminating. So this grounding in our basic practice of zazen is how we can refrain from the asrava or outflow that is so strong with speech, this energetic outflow, which we feel when we are both speaking and when we are being spoken to, right? It comes up together. as Halifax says, this is an energy which is produced in a mind that's very active and compulsive even when it's producing speech. So she asks, do you have a way to step down to a place where you can touch into your fundamental motivation? So this is a kind of digging deep into this, the Buddha's instructions. She says, why am I really here? What am I here to serve? And her suggestion is to treat in communication as a form of inquiry, right? Rather than, say, persuasion. So, of course, we use speech all the time, and we would not have the sutras or any wisdom teachings without words. And I am grateful to have Dogen's emphasis on compassion as the ground of right speech, or as he says when speaking of kind speech. Again, kind mind arises from the seed of compassionate mind. And it is this kind mind that expresses kind speech. Right? So compassion, kindness comes up with that, and your speech can align with that. And for me, this is helpful, this is personal now, because of our and my deep social and cultural conditioning, right? As I said, we may have some resistance to the imperative to offer kind speech if it feels that speech is, that kind speech is coercive. So, speaking from my own experience, right, if you're female, if you're a woman, you might resist having your speech policed. How come you're not kind? Aren't you supposed to be kind? You're a woman. You're supposed to be nurturing, right? You know, or gender normed in some way. Right? You're expected to be kind because of the form that you take. I've also heard some experienced practitioners, including some teachers, who have expressed a kind of resistance to this kind of bland, educated, privileged, white Protestant version of Buddhist speech that did not feel authentic to them. And this is not coming from here, this is coming from larger Zen centers where, you know, the original founders and the senior teachers are people who come from that kind of a background. And the kind of speech that avoids the truth of experience, right, that doesn't call out wrong uses of power or that is actually abusive but cloaked in calmness, right? It's abusive even if it's offered in calm and quiet tones. So this is complicated because we're complicated. How can we be simpler? And the individuals who express this dis-ease or even anger at this notion of kind, gentle speech, you know, be kind, sometimes we're from working class backgrounds or we're persons of color or came from different cultures. Right? It didn't feel like, it was like, is this really Buddhism or is this something else? And so some of these people experience the imperative to kind speech to be a kind of violence, right, or a falseness. Now the flip side of this response is that I've also heard individuals who grew up in situations of harsh or aggressive speech or physical violence express the relief that they felt at entering a practice space where an attempt, at least, was being made to control angry speech, where they felt some safety, or at least a sense of refuge, right? They expressed the relief they felt at entering a practice space where this was true, and to use kind words, even if it seemed to be a sort of performance, right? It modeled something other than what they had been conditioned to. So this, I think, forms this, these two kinds of views, or multiple views, of kind, is a good demonstration of deep inquiry, the kind of deep inquiry, if we can trust each other, the deep inquiry about intention and impact, and the principle of restraint with which we started. So Katagiri Roshi, whom we've been reading in an open study group this past month, in his book Returning to Silence, opens up Dogen's teaching on kind speech a little bit more, and I want to I'll round out this talk with his teaching. I think this is very helpful, and Roshi Joan, I found out, also thinks this is helpful. Katagiri says, kind speech is not merely speaking with an ingratiating voice, like a cat purring. He says, very naturally, consciously or unconsciously, this ingratiating is trying to get a favor by fawning or flattery, and this is not kind speech. Kind speech is not the usual sense of kindness. It can appear in various ways, but we should remember that it must constantly be based on compassion. Under all circumstances, that compassion is always giving somebody support or help or a chance to grow. So this compassion may not look like compassion. And again, this is where I think trust is important. Like, we can call people out, like, what did you mean by that? But if we're working from compassion, we can say, oh, I wasn't working from compassion, thank you. Or we can say, this was my intention. And along with this, Reb Anderson, whom we've also been reading in Precept Study, a former abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, he records an old story, which I really appreciate. This is about Master Ma in Tang Dynasty China. Reb really likes to look at the ancient stories of our Chinese ancestors. Master Ma shouted so loudly at his disciple Baizhang that Baizhang was deaf for 3 days. Now, it worked, that kind of abusive speech, what feels abusive to me, because this disciple also became a great Zen master, right? So we are asked to understand that this apparent violence was an act of compassionate, kind speech, right? It's difficult to accept, isn't it, right? It requires great faith. It requires also accepting that it doesn't always work out, because we can't control what happens, right? So we are asked to be brave, right? And this is another short story about such an incident from way deep in the past that Reb mentions. A student wanted to go to another teacher. He went to his teacher and said, I think I need to study with somebody else. Will you help me get there? And the student's original master sent him off, but he sent him off with a letter to the other teacher. And the letter characterized the student's understanding as limited and the student as having a limited capability to practice and understand Zen. Right? So he kind of tried to set up the student. He set up the student. And the student's encounter with the new teacher didn't go well. And in fact, it went so badly that the student went insane. And his original teacher, learning this, always regretted his letter and his mistake with this student. Right? So the consequences are sometimes quite grave when we go astray. Right? So Reb likes to say, you can't control anything. You can't even control yourself. This sounds kind of grim, but we just have to keep trying. Right? But the second part of Reb's statement, right, you can't control anything. Like, if you live long enough, you realize, no, even the things I think I'm controlling, I'm not really controlling. But the second part, you can't even control yourself, right? When I heard that from him in person, I thought, yeah, that's true, right? We were on a 5-day silent retreat, and we were actually all dealing with various impulses, which we were trying to control, right? To fall asleep, to run out of the room, right, all day long. And I thought, you know, rather than control, the approach to these things is more like allowing them to just arise and eventually to depart, which they will, right? This is a kind of fundamental Zen teaching on not controlling anything, not pushing away our thoughts or our feelings, not even controlling our breath, right? And this has really been a big help to my practice over the years. So in response to Reb's statement about not being able to control even myself, my first thought was, well, yeah, that's right. I can't control things like aging or sickness or death. You can tell where I am in my life right now. And in that sense, I couldn't control myself. But Tenshin Roshi's meaning goes beyond just that. Like, these things happen to all of us and to everyone we love and even people we don't love. Beyond just refraining from impulse or forcing our bodies and minds to behave, right? The other thing I rely on that Tenshin teaches is, in all things, in all circumstances, remember compassion. So, I'm going kind of long, and I don't want to keep you here too long, but I do want to say one last thing from Rhett. And I think this is really important when it comes to speech and everything else. He says, to live our lives on the path of the Buddhas, we have to let go of our fears of personal suffering and of not being in control of our lives. Otherwise, fear will undermine the bodhisattva life of vow and compassionate action. Right? I'll say that again. Fear will undermine the bodhisattva life of vow and compassionate action. Right? So, gather your courage and speak to people. Right? And for this, we also need patience. This is one of the six paramitas. Patience, as which Reb says, is being present and generous with our experience. Right? Generosity is the first of the paramitas. Giving. And Reb says, when we can be present with heat and cold, tiredness and sleepiness, or with people attacking us, we develop our capacity to also be present with the emptiness of phenomena. That means things don't have an independent existence. They're all interdependent with each other, everything. He says, if we are patient, if we don't move toward emptiness, and we don't turn away from it, we don't move toward emptiness and we don't turn away from it. We're still with it. We don't try to control ourselves to prevent turning away or to prevent turning toward or turning away from anything. He says, this is the activity of generosity, functioning within patience. Right? But he really warns us against confusing this patience, which I feel is really aligned with compassion and kindness. He warns us against confusing it with self-control. He says that we may think we are protecting others when we control our reactions to some things. But he says, I recommend instead that when we find ourselves attempting to control our feelings, we remember our wish to be generous, ethical, and patient in our dealings with ourselves and with others. Instead of attempting to control ourselves or others, we return to our aspiration to express an appropriate and compassionate response. Trying to control people and situations is stressful and draining. Patient compassion is not draining. So here's my conclusion. If we practice compassion in all circumstances, we have to extend it to ourselves as well. Control of anyone, including ourselves, is not conducive to liberation. We can practice what Hui Neng, the sixth Chinese ancestor of Zen, says about our vow to liberate all beings. He says, we vow to liberate all the beings in our minds. We welcome the difficult states as guests, and we invite them to sit with us. Fear, confusion, depression, illness, impulses to control, impulses to discriminate, with thorough and compassionate attention. As Tenshin Roshi says, in this teaching there is no end to the process of awakening and no final damnation either. There are only temporary damnations, so that our lapse becomes a part of the process of learning the true Dharma. The practices of compassion, founded in the insight into the truth of impermanence and total lack of independent self, which is wisdom, can help us find an appropriate response. That response may be refraining or acting, remaining silent as well as speaking, cultivating awareness in Zazen so that we can discern reality and live our vows is how we practice for the benefit of all beings. Thank you very much. Are there any comments, questions, objections, experiences? Deep sighs. Anne.
I had a conversation with someone who is grieving the death of a loved one yesterday, and this is a common theme, how many people that would normally be their support are avoiding them, and they ask, and he will ask, you know, I really would love your support. And they say, well, I just feel so uncomfortable because I don't know what to say. And we all know it's not what you're, it's just being there. What they're saying is not really that important. And I think that's a good example of where speech is not necessary, you know, a lot of it.
But there's communication happening too.
Yeah.
So that's a good place for the inquiry to arise.
Right.
Like, that's a great question. Like, why are you avoiding me?
Yeah.
And then maybe the response is, what? I don't know what you need.
Right.
I'm uncomfortable.
Right.
I don't
yeah.
know what you need.
Yeah.
And it may just be, I just need you to be there.
Yeah.
I don't need any words.
Yeah.
No. Yes?
I want to expand on Ann's comment.
Yeah.
A gentleman I know, I worked for, passed away recently, 3 weeks ago, very aggressive cancer. He opted to hold himself, his own pre-wake, so to speak.
Oh, gosh.
He invited many people to the party. I was shocked at the number of people who declined. Because I think it just makes them uncomfortable. So I'm just getting to that point. It's a different route.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I think that's why this kind of courage, you know, called upon to be uncomfortable and to find some stillness with the discomfort, you know, which is part of our path, at least, you know, like this generosity with your own discomfort. Right now I have an old friend. I probably met her. She's not a close friend, I should say, but I met her 30 or more years ago, and I've seen her on and off in recent years. This is a professional friend, and she's dying of metastatic breast cancer, and she has put up an amazing, I don't like the word fight when it comes to these things, but she's done everything to try to live. She has a lot of vitality and just took a turn suddenly and is in hospice. And her husband said, you can communicate with her through me. I'm reading every message that comes. And so people's hearts, I think, want to be with a situation like this sometimes, but they can't be there in person. Right? They just, it's too intense, or they don't know what to do. But technology gives us the opportunity now, at a distance, without getting too close, right, to say something. And there, last time I looked, there were 500 Facebook messages. Plus, she has a CaringBridge site. I don't know if you know this website, CaringBridge, where you can post and people can see your own words about how you're doing or what's happening. And that has a whole nother, right, you know, list of people. And she was a teacher, so her students are clocking in with their appreciations of her and how she transformed their lives. And so it's like a wake. It's an online wake, right? And the only people with her, as far as I know, in hospice are her immediate family. She has two children, adult children, and her husband, and maybe some close family. And we're all sitting vigil, you know, with this. I let two people I know who don't do social media and are not on Facebook, but who know her, you know, I sent them emails, and they said, how do I get in touch with Eric? And so, you know, this circle of response can be activated if people are comfortable. And I think our job is to, when it's right in front of us, not to turn away. Not just when it's like hundreds of miles away and you're not at the deathbed and you're not, right, you're not confronted with that suffering. But it's a start. I'm always very encouraged when I see this kind of thing happen. Like people care. They're often just overwhelmed. Charles, and then, please.
Two things. One is that I've found over time that being kind or having a kind response can not be perceived as being nice. It's very different from
yes.
being nice. And it was highlighted to me one time. I worked in a music school, and I was supposed to tune a piano in a voice faculty member's studio, and I was there at my time, and I could hear her having a conversation with a student inside, and all of a sudden the door burst open, and the student came rushing out in tears. And I went in, and my friend Darlene, she said, it was so hard. She said, I've had this girl for 3 years, and she really wants to have a professional singing career, and it was just not going to happen. I could see that was just not going to happen. And I kept putting off having this conversation with her before she started preparing for her senior year. And she said, I rehearsed it and talked over with my husband, and still, it just didn't go down well. And sometimes that's just, you just have to make your best effort and let the outcome be what it will. The other point is that I learned, there was a time when I was board chair here, and we were going through a difficult transition, and we had a trainer come in, and she was asking me to give her an account of what had been going on. She's from out of town. And I was really being very, very careful what I said, and she probably said, you know, you just need to tell me what's going on. I know your intention is good, you know. And I said, well, I had this model, and I forget where I got it. Somebody once said, don't ever write or say anything about someone else that you wouldn't be comfortable seeing on the front page of the Statesman. She said, that's a pretty high bar. And so she offered another one, which was that, and this is especially useful on social media, to imagine or visualize the person that you're writing to being right in front of you. Because I can be a little passive aggressive, I'm happy to confess. And so when I was younger, I would say things online that I would never say to someone's face. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I was afraid of the reaction, having to deal with the reaction. And so that really helped me a whole lot during that time. And it really transformed the whole way I do written communication. For instance, I almost never post on social media. Unfortunately, I'm a moderator, kind of a moderator on one group. And so I get to see, you know, well, yeah, that's really dangerous. But when you're writing to a large group of people, as opposed to visualizing one person in front of you, that's really hard, and it can, your words, no matter how carefully you examine your intention and carefully phrase it, it can be taken so many different ways by different people. So I've become really cautious about posting much of anything on social media just because of those experiences. But I think the key, I don't worry too much about if I meant for something to be a certain way, I thought it was true and it turned out it wasn't, or whatever, if my intention is good. But it's when I go on that automatic pilot and just let it out, and then later, so you just get up and dust yourself off and try again.
I think the that admonition about is it necessary works with social media.
Yeah.
Right. Do I really need to make this comment that I don't know who's going to see it? And what am I serving? What Joan Halifax add to this? She uses that term serving, which I bring up a lot here, but I really like it. It's like not helping, not fixing. What am I serving? Right? And you know, like in a bodhisattva way, the no self way, it's like this is not serving if I say this, right? Yeah. Thank you for that. And I don't know your name.
Balam.
Balam, did you? And also the person in front of you also, I think, had their hand up.
I'm Hannah.
Hannah. You did or didn't?
Didn't.
I'm sorry. So Balam, I saw your hand. Okay.
Thank you. As a person of color in the world that we live in,
yes.
This whole series on speech, it is a big challenge for me. And that's where my struggle is. How do I apply kind speech in a space that's not the most welcoming, the most kind? When is the right moment? How do we talk? The whole issue about manipulation, especially because I think speech in general did evolve to help us elicit reactions from other people. And so just wanted to share that this talk was important because this is at the core of part of my walk right now.
Thank you for your comment, yeah. Another person of color who was practicing with us this spring and has gone home for now, we'll be back in the fall, asked about compassion, if he needed to show compassion to people who didn't show him compassion, and who were, in fact, cruel to him, discriminated against him, saw him as lesser than. And I said, that's the teaching. That's the teaching. We're all human beings. We all have these capacities of compassion, loving kindness, kind speech. All the precepts, all the things the precepts point us to is the mind of Buddha, which is our mind. So that's the ask, and it's a huge ask, right? For all of us with our traumas and conditioning, but each of us has our own individual place in this net of experience, history, categories, right? So how do we each individually meet this challenge?
Well, and especially for us who have historically been conditioned to not speak.
Yes. Yes.
And is it kind? And is it necessary? And oftentimes it was necessary, but we were told not to for self-preservation.
Yes, and that's a calculation, unfortunately. Call it an inquiry rather than a calculation. What is the appropriate response in this situation? But I want to encourage you, whom I don't know, so please excuse me if this is not a skillful encouragement, that your speech can be very kind, even if it comes from a place of pain or anger or, you know, the trauma of generations, right? To bring it forward in a situation where it's invisible, people need to hear it. And I think one wonderful thing about an intentional community that is, you're all here open to hearing this Dharma, you know, the Dharma. It's not my Dharma, it's the Dharma. It's the way things really are, right? It's interdependence. This is a place to hope that you'll be met, whatever you say. Thank you. I don't want to leave out anybody. Is there anybody online? No. Okay. Yes, Eric.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between like noble silence and like Vimalakirti's silence, and then also all those koans where those monks they say something. I'll cut the cat, or I'll do this. Leave. I won't take my hat off. All these stories. So there's some fine line between we're in right speech to these things.
I think there's a whole aspect to this which I didn't get into because it's like a whole other talk. But I think it's touched on by the teachings of silence and stillness that we, you know, that are our practice when we're sitting. And what the part that I did kind of try to point in that direction was Joan Halifax talking about, you know, being on retreat, or just even here for 40 minutes, right? Leave your phone in the entryway, turn it off, right? Forget about it. Don't move, don't speak. See what happens when all the reaching toward things, constantly being controlled actually by things, when that is put down, what's there? It's harder and harder for me sometimes to get in touch with it because spend a lot of time online, a lot of time on Zoom, a lot of time talking to people. But when we're silent and still, I think that's what the koans are pointing to. There's one koan, it's the first in, I forget which of the collections, maybe the Blue Cliff Record, where the world-honored one, the Buddha, is getting up on the seat to speak, right? So like what I did, I do the whole thing, sit down, sits there for a while and then gets down. Doesn't say anything, right?
No.
And the Bodhisattva Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, you know, goes, the teaching is thus, right? So there's also many of these stories are 30 blows if you say something and 30 blows if you don't, right? So how do we practice with that? And that, I think, is the courage. Right? Katagiri says you have to say something, and you're saying something even when you don't say something. That's still a response. So looking at this as communication and having the courage to step into that space and be curious, I think, And I want to also say I gave this talk for myself, right, to remind me. It's the impulse to control can be very strong when you're sitting up here. You know, this is this thing. It's like they give you a stick when you become a teacher. I should give you this. It's like, okay.
They don't give you the Curatolo stick
anymore. Oh, the one where you actually hit people. Yeah, we stopped hitting people. Really, this is a thing in some temples, you know, and it's compassion, though. It's meant to be helpful to wake you up, and you ask for it, right? There's somebody who wanders up and down the zendo with this kyosaku, right? Looking very fierce, and if you would like to be to get the wake-up stick, you put your hands in gassho, people bow to each other, and then, you know, you turn your head so it hits the muscle of your shoulder, whack, whack, and then there's more bows, right? And I've been in zendos where that was happening, and it's really noisy, for one thing. You know, it's like the noisiest thing. But in our culture, to a lot of people, it is triggering. You know, it reminds people of violence that they've experienced or been witness, that or they've witnessed. And that's one reason we stopped doing it like a generation ago in San Francisco Zen Center. Just like, this is, we don't need this. There are other ways of encouraging people physically. So sometimes in a retreat, the teacher will go around and with permission, will just very gently, like, help you be a little more upright, maybe, you know, make a suggestion, like your head's fallen forward, just kind of like, you know. And if you don't want that touch, you can refuse it, right? So always with permission. So we adapt. This is not medieval Japan, although sometimes it looks like it. Yes?
My name is Jenny, and thank you so much for your nuanced talk. No, truly, it's not just flattering speech. But so many things.
I'm flattered.
Good. As you should. I really appreciate the conversation about power and trauma. And as a white person, you know, one of the things that I struggle with is in terms of social media, for example, you know, I feel myself committed. I am committed to justice issues and gender and race and, you know, and also I feel this, like, draw to the performance, you know, of saying I'm a good white person, you know, look at what I'm saying and what I'm posting, and I went to this rally, and I, you know, and then I struggle also with, well, is there value in me putting that out there, right, and saying there are white people that are committed, but also am I taking up space, you know, and what is the motivation there? And so it has to be honest, you know, with what I struggle with in that area.
It's a big conversation, you know. It might be helpful, I'll do this, if, I think, when I get home, I'll try to remember, to post this talk of Joan Halifax, which I drew on pretty heavily, because the other part of it I didn't talk about is she is part of the Zen Peacemaker Order, which is explicitly, you know, socially justice-oriented, and way predates everything that's been emerging again, you know, crawling out from under various rocks in recent years. And she talks about speech and social justice, and she quotes that the kind of speech that she ends with, which I didn't reference here, is prophetic speech. And so I think I'll post it and let you all read it and see if it's helpful. But it's specifically about the speech that accompanies, the speech that speaks truth to power, and how we do that in a way that's coming from compassion and our intention, rather than from just being angry, right? Just being really angry, or devastated, you know, or, yeah. How do we do it? Okay, Hannah first, and then.
I was just wondering if you could repeat the quote that was like about fear, and it said like two things to remember. It was like towards the end.
Towards the end, yeah, this is red. Whom I don't think of as a kind of justice warrior, but actually in some ways he is. Those of you who know Red, by the way, he will be 80 this month. Let's see, what does he say? Fear, he talks about fear.
He said there were like two
He says, to live our lives on the path of the Buddhas. I think this is probably it or close to it. We have to let go of our fears of personal suffering and of not being in control of our lives. Otherwise, fear, this is a quote that I think applies to us all, fear will undermine the bodhisattva life of vow and compassionate action. So confronting our fear, whether you're the speaker or the spoken to, whether you're speaking or receiving, and then, you know, when you then respond, like being able to be with fear. And a good place to start that is in a place where there's some refuge, some sense of refuge.
I'm a birth doula, and I am trying to figure out ways to help people be with their fear, because I think that's one of the main things that can lead to a not as healing birth experience. And it's hard figuring out ways to help people face their fears. Because it's your own work you have to do. But I feel like it's a struggle for me to figure out how to help people come to that. So that quote was really helpful.
Thank you. It's kind of like birth and death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Death is the other door, you know, where this comes up strongly. And I think we don't have in Zen that much to say about birth, actually, but a lot to say about death.
Yeah.
And
but they're really the same.
They are, and I think that being with, sometimes it's phrased as coming alongside, you know, like a ship. Mm. You know, come alongside and offer your assistance that is just sometimes just being there calmly and reassuringly and being a human with another human.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, and I think maybe, Elliot, did you have your hand up too? Okay, so these last two. Yeah, go ahead.
So with respect to the impact that your speech or your actions have on someone, how do you take, you know, there's so many factors, including yourself and the other person and the environment. So how do you take the impact and learn from it, purify your intentions with all that ambiguity?
Usually I think we have a sense of the impact even if the other person doesn't tell us in words. You can see it on their face or feel it in their energy shift. Or I had an encounter with somebody that I really deeply regretted, and this person called me out and we had a conversation. A really honest conversation, and we, at the end of it, I think we restored some trust in our intentions toward each other, and in and renewed. This person was a practitioner, so we renewed our vows, and you know, and I tried to be very vulnerable and transparent in this conversation, you know, honest about myself and my own habits, and my reactivity, which came to the fore in that particular encounter. Feeling very stressed and tired, but that's not an that's an excuse, which isn't an absolution, right? And then we dusted ourselves off and got up and went back to being together. But the other thing about being in sangha, in this kind of community, and that sangha can be your work, community or whatever, your family, your friends, trying to model this for others and hoping they'll and encouraging them take it up as, that hurt me, or what did you mean by that? Or maybe not so much blame, but when I hear that, this is how I feel. Rather than saying, you always do this, or what you said this, and blaming the other person, but saying, this is the impact on me. And bringing it to that person's attention and asking them, and sometimes they'll say, too bad. oh, I don't care, or, that happens. But trying to be in conversation, which is really what we all are, it's a giant conversation all the time, whether we're speaking or not. Mm-hmm. And learning always to the end, and then the next lifetime, like Dogen says, and the one after that. So don't give up. Don't give up. Okay, Elliot, you get the last word.
It was actually very closely related. So I have an anecdote first, that when I was, 12 years ago now, I was an undergrad, and I wanted to go to grad school. And I asked the professor, and I said, hey, I think I want to go to grad school. Can we talk about it? And he said, well, let's look at your transcripts. And I was like, that's the way he started the conversation.
Dear.
He said, well, your grades are going down. You've only been in lower div, and you just got a C-. So I think this is really not the path for you. Unless you really turn this around. Change it. And he was like, feel free to come back and talk to me whenever you want about this. And to be fair, I did turn it around, and then I did get into grad school, and it's why I'm in Texas. So, like, if I hadn't had that conversation with him, I wouldn't be here in Texas. But that was extremely difficult. And it was extremely blunt, and I didn't really have the trusting relationship with him that I think would have justified him doing that. And I don't think I had the relationship with him to go back to him and say, like, if that hadn't worked on me, I would not have felt safe going back and telling him. So I wanted to ask you about the responsibility to own that impact, because I could have been that student that went insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah.
I had a similar experience when I was an undergraduate. I really thought I wanted to go to grad school. And I had a wonderful teacher who had been nothing but encouraging, right? You know, my advisor, whom I really, just Miranda, I thought she was great. I wanted to be Miranda, you know? And she said, you know, it's like a really hard row. It's like, you know, 8 years of this particular field. And at the end, they're like, no jobs. She was not wrong. So she was sort of trying to spare me. But I thought, wait, you know, I'm like this devoted student who really is, you know, wants to be in this racket. And I kind of ignored her. Like, I went ahead and I applied to grad school and I asked her for a letter of recommendation, knowing that she might not highly recommend me out of this sense of, like, you know. She also told me that my senior thesis project was completely unviable and I had to abandon it. And she was right, because I wasn't going to get permission to actually view the material I wanted to look at. It was kind of sequestered by the Greek government. I had to do something else. So it wasn't kind to me. It didn't feel kind, and it felt undermining, you know, actually. But I just decided, I'm going to try. I'm going to turn it around. But that's not to deny the impact. It was really discouraging. Now, I don't know where I'd be or what I'd be doing if I had not gone to grad school. God only knows, right? So Buddha only knows. Somebody must know what the alternate timeline would be. But, you know, a Zen teacher, when I said, I don't know whether to leave where I am and go practice with get a new job and practice with the community that I had formed an attachment with, you know, a Sangha, or whether I should stay where I am in a very, you know, nice situation professionally and personally. And she said, whatever you do, you can't make a mistake. And I thought, what the heck can that possibly mean? But I later felt like it meant it's your life unfolding, right? Whatever happens. Be there for your life. So you wouldn't be in Texas, but you'd be doing something, living your life. However, how auspicious that here you are. All of you. Here you are. All these different paths. Karma of lifetime after lifetime. You don't know. Let the native Texans feel outnumbered.
No, I was just an aside. I was wondering how many people are native Texans here.
Let's do a poll. How many people are from here, originally?
Cool. Born in Texas.
Born in Texas.
Born in Texas, that counts.
Born in Texas.
Born in Texas. That's what I mean by native.
Yes.
I'm not, definitely not.
Yes.
I'm a damn Yankee. Thank you all so much for all of your practice.